I'm John Gormley. Thank you for being here wherever you may be on this day, on a pretty gray, dodgy Saskatchewan day. But God, what's new? We've had more rain and more gray this summer than any in living memory. Writing recently in the Globe and Mail and a paper on behalf of a new think tank in Canada called the McDonald Laurier Institute, a great commentary on what's ahead for a Canadian challenge on refugee claimants like the 490 Tamils who showed up on that ship on the West Coast a week ago. Scott Newark, former Alberta Crown Prosecutor, Executive Director of Canadian Police Association. Mr. Newark writes that there are challenges ahead that we need to face. Now, for a lot of you who've been following the plight of refugees, whether last fall in the 76 Tamils who arrived, whether this group, whether others over the past few years, you know that in Canada it is the law. And in our charter ruling under Section 7, guarantees every Canadian right to life, liberty, and security of the person, the Supreme Court back in 85, in the so-called Singh case, ruled that anyone claiming refugee status present in Canada, so once you are in Canada, inside our territorial waters, on our soil, you must have the opportunity to present your case in the form of an oral hearing. In other words, you must be heard. Now, the fact that you are not a Canadian citizen, the fact that you have just arrived, was something that the court, there were three dissenters in that judgment, but the majority of the court in 85 said the charter would give you that protection. Now, many have said, we should have a whole new look-see at this. We find Scott Newark in Brockville, Ontario this morning. Scott, thanks for taking our call.
My pleasure.
Can you walk me through what the challenges are that this Tamil case now pose to our refugee determination process?
Yeah, and your introduction, I think, makes the point. The reality is what makes it a challenge operationally is that these folks arrived at the border. And our system is such that we then process them when they're there. And so when people arrive in large numbers like this, it overloads a system. And also what's happened here, too, is these folks have deliberately chosen to avoid some of the pre-screening requirements that our regular process has for people who want to apply to be refugees. And that obviously puts an extra strain on the system. So it's not simply that, you know, Canada has this reputation for generosity in accepting refugee claimants. Trust me, we have an equally well-known reputation for not being particularly efficient at the way in which we make refugee determinations and then allow for multiple appeals, including releases while that's going on. That's a feature that is sufficiently well-known that people who want to take advantage of that and not necessarily go through the same screening procedures, literally take advantage of. That's what causes the problem, though, John, is that they all arrived essentially and said, hi, we're here. We now like to be processed, please. And, you know, as you can tell from following along in the media, that puts a strain on the system. And the presumption of our process is not that we're going to have people detained for long periods of time. That's not generally the way that we do things. And I think it's not particularly cynical to say that that is in fact counted on.
Yeah, and if they're paying between $30,000 and $50,000 a head, clearly this is almost bargained for in their contract.
Well, you know, I'll tell you a couple things about that. First of all, the notion, I think most people's sort of sense of what would constitute a refugee aren't people walking around with $50,000. And secondly, I assure you there are people on that ship that didn't have that amount of money, and instead, this is, as I put it in the article, the people running this are not doing it as a charity. Those folks will be, shall we say, working inland to pay it off, and this is where you'll see people brought into criminality, and among the most serious and horrendous of human exploitation of the most vulnerable people. So it has a domestic consequence for us as well, too. Not to mention apparently the individuals responsible for this. I think the best you can probably say is that they're organized. It's an organized criminal enterprise. The worst may be an awful lot worse than that, in that there is certainly information that suggests this is organized by the Tamil Tigers. or nasty group. I had a bit of a hand in the procedure in having them listed as a terrorist organization, and I assure you they are a bunch of thugs in particular who prey on their own people in this country. So there's that element as well, too, is that, you know, sort of mixed amongst all of this crowd of 492 are the people who potentially are part of that Tamil Tiger organization. And the reports so far, John, are that the, guess what? The people who were the crew of the ship, they kind of all blended into the passengers, and nobody's talking about who the crew is.
Yeah, good point. Scott Newark is here. Scott, a former Alberta Crown Prosecutor, advising the McDonald Laurier Institute on this immigration piece. Now, you cite case law where, although you go back to Singh, which determines in 1985 this right to make your oral representation, but other court cases since, the Chiarelli decision, the Charcui decision, you know, these into the 90s and later, that essentially say, non-citizens can be treated differently. So it's not like we're completely handcuffed.
I'm glad you raised that, because I suspected you'd read Ezra Levant's columns when you were talking about the Singh case.
Yeah.
People have this assumption that the Singh case means there's nothing we can do, and that is completely wrong. And a lot of people forget, when you got to go back and read the judgment, but essentially Singh and I think it was six other people were making a claim for refugee status years ago. They were denied. They were appealing that. And part of what their argument was that the process that was in place then violated their charter rights. Well, the Federal Department of Justice, instead of arguing, well, no, it doesn't, and here's why, and here are the details or anything else, they were the ones who put forward the argument that non-citizens don't have charter rights. And the Supreme Court said, yes, they do. So that has been, over the years, taken to be this sort of immovable obstacle. And trust me, it is very much used in Ottawa. It's known as charter angst.
Yes.
when you can't do something or you don't want to do something, just say it'll be against the charter. Carefully drafted legislation that is purpose-specific, where we identify why we're doing what we're doing, and we put it into the, it's known as a preamble to the bill. The courts are required to take notice of it. In my opinion, there's already tons of examples where we make distinctions. We could certainly craft reforms to deal with the kind of situations you and I are talking about this morning. So it may be a lot more work for the Department of Justice lawyers, but frankly, I think it's time they earn their paychecks.
The human rights bar, though, and the immigration bar go on at great length about deflection. You know, to deflect a refugee puts you offside with international covenants, it puts you offside with international law. Are you talking, frankly, I don't buy that, but are you talking about an ability to deflect after some kind of summary process?
Basically, if you make a choice to attempt to avoid our screening requirements,
yep,
think then there should be consequences, like, for example, offshore screening of people so that you can't simply be released into the country and then potentially disappear, not allowing for the normal practice of the issuance of temporary residence permits, which are essentially, well, okay, we're going to turn you down, but you have a right to appeal, and here's a permit you can go inside the country while you appeal. If somebody chooses to avoid the regular screening process, by all means, you can still appeal, but you can do it from out of country. Things like that, not allowing temporary residence permits to be issued for people who are determined to be inadmissible. Let's say, for example, we find people among the group of people on the ship who would be inadmissible to Canada, whether they're refugees or not, and they wouldn't be allowed to claim refugee status if they had a particular criminal history. The law still permits us, and we actually do it. Notwithstanding all of that, we still give some people those temporary residence permits to come into the country while they appeal. We could prevent all of that on defined grounds, in my opinion, if we tailor it specifically to the circumstances that we're dealing with. A lot of people have asked about, well, assuming we find these people, the people who organize this is an offense under the Immigration Refugee Protection Act, potentially also under the Criminal Code, depending on what happens afterwards. Okay, we don't... Let's assume for a second the people are prosecuted and convicted. You know what somebody can get for organizing this effort?
Mm.
Probation.
Yeah, of course.
Okay, it's a life imprisonment, but in our system, which has, you know, broad sentencing discretion to it, that also means potentially probation. That's not much of a deterrent, in my experience. We also don't allow, even if somebody was sentenced to incarceration, okay, in this country under the International Transfer Offenders Act, we can send somebody back to serve their sentence in their own country, in a jail in their own country, but there's a little bit of a catch to it. Three parties are involved and all have to consent. Canada, the home country that the person would serve their sentence in, and the offender. Guess what? Not many offenders consent to go and serve their sentences. So you could change that legislation for defined specific offenses. Take it in combination, in other words, John, some specific, tailored things to take the incentive out of this kind of a process and turn it into a negative.
Before I let you go, Scott Newark, when you talk about a potential offshore process, there's a big wide ocean between us and Asia. So how do you deal with that? They've been turned away in Australia. They've been turned away in Thailand. They're getting turned away in other countries. But how do you actually prevent them from then entering domestic Canadian waters?
That's probably in the long run operationally the most significant thing. We're going to need to work with the countries over there. There was intelligence about this ship to begin with. There was intelligence about two other potential ships as well, too. We're going to need to find the ways to, through mutual legal assistance treaties with countries, and not just simply, in that part of the world, but elsewhere, to disrupt this before it takes place. We have something called the Safe Third Country Agreement with the United States as well, too, where if somebody comes, say, across the land border from the United States, and they say, hi, I'd like to be a refugee, we say, well, actually, you may not like living in, say, Buffalo or something, but you're not really at risk there. What you're really saying is I'd rather be a refugee in Canada than the United States. If these people came from, for example, as has been reported, not from Sri Lanka, but instead from Tamil Nadu state in southeastern India, what they're really saying is, no, thanks, we'd rather be a refugee in Canada than there. Those are the kinds of international agreements we're going to have to, I think, do an awful lot better job on as well to prevent us dealing with this. Exactly as you say, the time to be dealing with this is not when they arrive at the shore.
Good point, Scott Newark. Always great hearing from you, sir. Thank you.
Nice talking with you.
All right, Scott Newark, advising in this issue the McDonald Laurier Institute. His commentary called the Sunsea Tamil Mass Refugee Claim an opportunity for needed reforms. So he argues that even using Canadian law today, you can structure laws. Again, remember this. We're not against refugees in Canada. We're not against humanitarian relief for those who are suffering. But have you noticed? Every single poll that's been done on this Tamil case shows 2/3 of Canadians or more believe we're getting conned. The mainstream media, the left-wing commentators, the immigration bar, and the human rights bar have their knickers in a knot over this being so un-Canadian to push back. It's not. You're on the right track. 1-877-332-8255. What do you think? Time for changed Canadian laws? I think long overdue. I'm Gormley. This is News Talk Radio. John Gormley, going to good read Scott Newark's piece for the MacDonald Laurier Institute. That's, of course, an institute named after Sir John A. MacDonald, that's M-A-C, and Sir Wilfrid Laurier. And his name is Scott Newark, N-E-W-A-R-K. And if you Google those words, you will find his paper, which deals with the Sunsea Tamil mass refugee claim. Here's his point. We should attempt to establish an offshore system of processing where you also prohibit or at least restrict anybody getting a temporary residence permit that allows them to live in the community. So the idea is that if you come in not seeking a visa, in some other country where you say, I intend to make a refugee claim to Canada, please, I need a visa. You just decide to jump in a ship and head for our shores. Once we intercept you, you aren't going to get those temporary residence permits. In other words, you're going to be held in a facility, in a jail, until this whole process goes. We should also deny temporary residence permits and inland appeals to anyone with an initial finding who's been involved in serious criminal activity, human rights violations, threats, this sort of thing. So in other words, if you come up as a bad dude, there's no inland appeal. We determine you're not suitable, so you're not getting a temporary residence permit. So in other words, we're going to hold you anyway. You don't get an appeal, so you get sent back. So that's for the worst of the worst. The others, you would move a lot more quickly to make a determination on why is it they chose to go under the radar by jumping on a boat. Also, and Newark points this out too, quote, through these and other changes, we can preserve our humanitarian traditions while rewarding those who play by the rules and deterring or punishing those who do not. And he makes the point, and this is where it's important to remember, the 1987 Singh case And a lot of you have been really twisted about this, and I'm glad you are. But the Singh case, again, remember when you read cases, there's a thing called the ratio, what you take away from that. Sorry, we'll do legal writing 101 another day. But the Singh case has begun to stand for the proposition that non-citizens who are making a refugee claim have the right under the charter to have an oral hearing here. But that's a very narrow case. Two other cases, one was the 1992 Chiarelli decision, says it's a principle of immigration that non-citizens do not have an unqualified right to enter or remain in the country. It's clear. A non-citizen doesn't just a right to show up here. Back in 2005, Justice McLaughlin in the Charcoui decision said it's clear. A deportation scheme that applies to non-citizens doesn't violate the equality provisions of the Charter. You can deport non-citizens. You can't deport a citizen. There's your difference. So the courts have been aware of the subtleties, but the policymakers, the human rights lawyers, the immigration bar, the left-wing liberal crowd, have been all over this idea that Canada simply has to accept whoever shows up here. In the U.S. and Canada, we have a treaty. If you land there first and then try and apply here for refugee status, it's called the principle of asylum shopping, and it's called a preference system. Wherever you land first, there's your refugee claim. We don't have that kind of treaty with other countries. Why don't we? So I think most Canadians, and do not apologize to anyone, you are in that category of most, who says this entire Tamil case is making Canada look like a country that's too easy. This is News Talk Radio. I'm John Gormley. Thank you for being here. And it remains not just my privilege, but my honor to be with you every single day, 4 hours. And we catch the stories of the day. What fuels your passion on the radio?